Les colloques du Collège de France.
It is a great honor to introduce Gene Heckman's keynote lecture address. So I will say a few words about you, for we all know you well, but there are, you know, some people attend the conference who are not familiar with what we do and what you've done. So it's a great honor to introduce Jim's keynote address. Jim is a Kuhnian innovator in the profession, and his contribution to economics and econometrics is extensive. Its impact stretches the boundaries between econometric theory and policy evaluation, between microeconometrics and microeconomics, and between statistics and econometrics. Jim's research concentrated initially on the analysis of household decision making, with particular focus on labor supply and consumption decisions. In particular, Jim pioneered the theoretically consistent empirical models of labor supply and consumption, which still serve as a basic tool in frontier research on these topics. But what earned Jim his Nobel Prize in 2000 is primarily his work on the selection bias, the so-called selection model, which lies at the heart of all serious econometric investigations of individual economic behavior in non-experimental settings. In particular, Jim's 1979 econometrica paper entitled Sample Selection Bias as a Specific Error remains essential reading for any scholar in empirical microeconomics. Jim's name is unavoidable. In French, we say incontournable. Incontournable for anyone interested in economic policy evaluation or facing issues of heterogeneity, diversity, and unobserved counterfactual states. Jim's research has had a major influence on policy design and on policymakers' mind, in particular his work on the economic benefits of sorting in the labor market and on the economic returns to education, starting with early childhood education. Equally important is your work on job training, on anti-discrimination laws, civil rights. For example, Jim identified a strong causal effect of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 on African-American progress. In more recent work, and contrary to the view put forward by some geneticists whom I won't name here, you showed that high IQ matters less for financial success than diligence, perseverance, and self-discipline. Jim's has published over 300 articles, plus several influential books. He's a member of the National Academy of Science, of the American Philosophical Society, and many other prestigious societies. Jim has received numerous prestigious prizes besides the Clark Medal and the Nobel Prize. Despite all your achievements and numerous marks of recognition, you have remained accessible, Jim. Hence, Richard Blondel, for example, praises your willingness to discuss ideas at any time of day and night by email or whatever means. I don't know what he means by that. I remember myself mails in capital letters. Now you abandoned the capital letter. I remember when we were pushing for Phelps Nobel Prize together. Right. You were using capital letters. Now you've moved into a lowercase letter. But you have to explain why. Is that... thanks so much, Jim, for accepting...
I had to convince him.
That's right, exactly. Exactly. Thanks so much, Jim, for accepting our invitation to deliver this keynote. The floor is yours. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. I'm not sure it's deserved, but I will take it. I am a little bit apprehensive. I'm kind of not a member of the club. I mean, the club has been pretty well defined, and so I'm kind of an outside observer, but finding the observations very interesting and informative, so I'm glad to be here today. I am going to talk about something that I normally do not talk about in some ways. You mentioned the Nobel Prize nomination. I was engaged in the activity of nominating Svi for the Nobel Prize on numerous occasions, and unfortunately, the attempts failed. So what I'm about to show you may have been a reason for the failure, and you can decide that yourself. I think he actually was truly deserving, and Manuel mentioned that in the prize ceremonies 2000, Dan and I both seriously raised that question with the committee, and they kind of apologized, but that's, you know, these are politics and not all academic motivation. So I want to talk about Zvi and give you a little bit of background about Zvi that'll help motivate not just what all of you know, although some of you know more than I do, so I'm more than happy for you to stop and tell me I'm wrong, I'm misrepresenting him. Manuel in particular isn't afraid of speaking out, so we enjoy jousting, so I'll be happy to joust back too. But I did know Zvi in many ways over the years, and starting from my, I guess my early entry into professional economics, in the sense that he was the editor of Econometrica, and he was also a very influential person in econometrics. And I was started at Columbia University, and he would visit Columbia. He had already gone from Chicago to Harvard, but he came around a lot, and he spoke. And then he came back to Chicago frequently when I was at Chicago, and he frequently gave seminars, and we had a chance to interact. And then, of course, he handled a number of papers of mine at Econometrica. And even when he wasn't handling papers or even rejecting them, he was actually always very informative and very useful in discussion. So over the years, we had a lot of stimulating discussions. So I'm going to talk today about Zvi. You have a picture, the same picture that you see in your program, but I'll give you another picture in a minute because I want to get back a little bit of context to Zvi and how he got where he was and how these issues arose. And I think it helps explain his work, his body of work, not just in the sense any particular piece of work, many of which you know have huge influence on all of your work, it's clear from the discussions in the last day and a half, but also the fact that there's a continuity, and I want to try to explain the continuity, and if I can, a little bit, tell an origin story. So that was not in the Nobel Prize nomination. So this is an addition. I couldn't just read the same thing over again. It's probably. But also, as I say, there are many people here who knew Zvi as well, or probably even better than I did. And so I hope they correct me, stand up in the middle and say, no, that's dead wrong. And it might well be. So I'm going to give a little bit of background. And I'm going to give you some background that I can have, I think, can provide that most of you can't. And that is that Zvi had a very, of course, you all know the story. Manuel's written just this document that was circulated a couple of days ago that actually summarized very succinctly and very clearly the story, which we all know is remarkable. Here's a guy who suffers from enormous persecution with a lot of disabilities put on his back by the nature of the experience in World War II, but bounces back. And so his high level of intelligence and resilience is a real remarkable feature of his work and of all of his work and of his thinking. But I want to talk a little bit about some of his background. And in particular, I'm going to talk initially not about Steve, but I'm going to talk about his mentor, T.W. Schultz. Now, many of you probably don't know T.W. Schultz all that well. I knew T.W. very well. His office was across the hall from me. I got to know him very well. And T.W. had a very, very high opinion of Zvi to the very end. I mean, he died just a year or so before Zvi did. And I visited him in his old age. He was in an old folks' home up in Evanston. And I visited him quite a few times. And he spoke about Zvi with great admiration. And Zvi spoke about him with great admiration. And it's interesting because it shapes the form of what the kind of problems that he worked on, Zvi worked on. So I'm not going to say that Zvi was a clone of T.W. Schultz. What I am going to say, he was inspired by a body of work and an approach to economics that nonetheless, I think, all has influenced you. So Schultz was a person, he was born in 1902, I think, and died around 1997. He was lived to a very ripe old age. But he was a true original. Anybody who knew him, Pete, I don't know, did you ever meet him? You met him. So you saw him near the end, but he was still very robust, going to seminars and anxious to engage. But he was somebody who was original. And in some ways, he shared some of Zvi's own life. But not in the horror of the Nazi Europe, but in the sense that when he was a young man, his father took him out of school and had him work on the farm for a while. So he didn't have a high school education either. He was working on the farm, and somehow he made his way into South Dakota State University, and from there on to the University of Wisconsin. But if you look at his career at Wisconsin, Wisconsin was a very strong institutional school. And so the institutionalists have died out. They were originally founded by Veblen, who was at one point at Chicago. But there's a very classic picture of him, which I unfortunately couldn't find. I wonder if somebody could dig it out. It's a picture of Schultz sitting there with John Commons and Elizabeth Brandeis and a number of others at an agricultural workshop in Wisconsin in the late 20s. And there's a great poster in the background. It's almost like a Soviet poster, except it's talking about, you know, land reform. And it's almost like it shows an American version of the man with a hoe, but in the background. And anyway, so he was very much engaged in that kind of applied economics and social policy. He studied U.S. agriculture. That was his theme. He was a farmer from origin. And he became, after he got his PhD, he went to Iowa State. And in his role at Iowa State, he showed enormous judgment of talent, policy, being able to get people who were very high quality. So at one point, he had in Iowa State in the 1930s, George Stigler, people like Gerhard Tentner, Margaret Reed, Hurwitz, and Albert Hart, just to name some. These are remarkable assembly. And he was responsible. And he played a similar role at the University of Chicago. And he had a similar role in spotting Zvi, in understanding what Zvi had to offer and how he could engage him. But if you look at his work, and so Schultz's work was on disequilibrium. And disequilibrium was the theme in American agriculture. People think of Iowa as kind of a very placid, you know, but it wasn't. It was a place showing enormous amount of change, especially in the technology. And in fact, there's somebody you know more in political terms. I don't know how many know who Henry Wallace was, but he was vice president under Roosevelt. But before he became vice president or secretary of agriculture, he was part of a culture of, I think it was called Wallace's Farmer. It was an Iowa newspaper. And he did a lot of work, both inside, before he went into government and then after he went out of government, in developing hybrid corn. And Iowa was deeply engaged in development of new technologies. And also, Schultz was deeply engaged in kind of understanding this kind of phenomena of how hybrid corn and how the hybrids had been developed. I don't know if it originated in Iowa, but it certainly was a major focal point of the work in Iowa. And the interesting thing about the agricultural developments in Iowa, where you had both a Department of Economics, and you had what were called research stations or extension outlets. And these extension outlets were part of the department. So what you had is that farmers were actually voting on tenure for some of these faculty members. And at the same time, they were looking for advice. And the faculty members were actually looking at what helped farmers make increased productivity. And of course, hybrid played a major role. So anyway, there's a lot of controversy. I don't want to go on. This is a conference about Zvi, not about TW. But it is the case that when TW went to Chicago, he built an all-star cast. He was chairman of the department between like 46 and 61. And you can see that he played a very major role. He didn't bring Coles, but he was very close to Koopmans. And he basically was a peacemaker. There's been a lot of violence between Friedman and the Coles group, but it wasn't from T.W. Schultz and so forth. Zvi came to Chicago, I think, in 1953 or so. He was a Berkeley MA student, and he came into this environment. But his background was in agricultural economics. And people nowadays don't think much about agricultural economics. It's not the active field that it was. But if you looked at what was going on in that field, it was enormous. And in fact, it really explains a lot of what Zvi did. His early work was really looking at disequilibrium, looking at the residual, looking at the trying to explain and leave open certain questions that Schultz was not a very quantitative person. In fact, probably a person like Schultz couldn't make it into an economics department these days. Just wasn't that technical. On the other hand, he recognized high quality talent, as you could see, both in the way he built Iowa State and the way he fostered people like Zvi Grelickus. And Schultz was deeply interested in technical change and explaining the progress in agriculture. So Zvi walked into this, having a background from agriculture, I guess, in Israel originally, and then I think it was an agricultural degree from Berkeley, right? MA degree. So Zvi naturally moved to this group. But this group wasn't just a group of slouches. This wasn't some marginal seminar. This was a group of people that included people like Mark Nerlove. It included a guy named Ehud Grunfeld, who was, unfortunately, he died at a very early age, but he was considered to be one of the promising people. Nerlove was very active. And so this seminar was very much affected by that. And Zvi, when he was a student at the University of Chicago, was actually heavily influenced by not only that seminar and by his interactions with Schultz. And Schultz, by the way, was influenced by Zvi. There's a very early paper by Schultz, where he's talking about the residual. And he says, you know, I have a student, graduate student here at the University of Chicago, suggested, you know, there's a residual that seems to be explaining agricultural productivity. And a student of mine, Zvi Grelickus, suggested I might want to explain the residual. That kind of set in motion a lifetime of activity. So he was deeply engaged in this, but from this problem. Then there was another theme, which I think all of you will recognize who know Zvi's work. This is probably the one single equation that was throughout his entire work. Tile visited Chicago when Zvi was a graduate student, and this had a huge influence on him. Tile, Zvi always cited Tile for this, but this specification bias formula became, in fact, a passion for Zvi throughout his life. He organized his studies on agricultural productivity and quality differentials and so forth. Just the standard formula, but it wasn't standard in the 1950s. You have to understand that when he was understanding this and doing this work, it was still a major innovation for economists to be using regression. I met a lot of these people who were the old timers, if you will, who were actually had learned regression theory in their mid 40s or late or early 50s. And so Zvi was able to essentially communicate and also arbitrage in a way, just as his mentor, T.W., played a role, but not technical in form. So the Schultz workshop had people like Nerlove, Grelickus, and Grunfeld. And then there was also the role of Harberger and so forth. And another visitor who played a very important role, who was Havamo, who the guy who was working and developed simultaneous equation theory in econometrics, was a visitor and was doing his work on investment theory. So when Zvi was a graduate student, Coles was in the middle of leaving Chicago. And so as a result, he was somehow the transitional figure. He was filling in for the missing econometricians, whom all went off to Yale. And so although Schultz had no trouble, and certainly he and Koopmans got along to the very end, not so much so with Savage and Friedman with the Coles group. It was a savage relationship, to put it mildly. So let me talk specifically then about the outgrowth of this and try to draw back on these themes and what he did, what I say he did, and you can tell me if I've missed something on the list, and I'm more than happy to be corrected. But I would argue there are three major contributions, and they're related in ways that maybe you hadn't thought about, or maybe you've thought about, and I'm boring you to tears, so there's the exit back there, so you can go if you want. First of all, and this was stimulated, I think, by some of Schultz's early work about the social rate of returns to research activity. Schultz and the whole group at Iowa State were deeply concerned about trying to improve agricultural productivity in Iowa, and it involved a lot of technology and a lot of new ideas. I mentioned Henry Wallace, but there were many others who were engaged in developing the technologies. So one question was, what was the return, and what was the nature of the diffusion of the technology? How is it that some farmers adopted it and some did not? That was an open question, which Zvi was in considering these questions. And certainly, he got the stimulation in part from the studies from Schultz, who was working on this question. Secondly, and in a related way, when trying to understand productivity change, he got into the whole question about quality adjustment. anybody who looks at inputs knows you need to look at quality. And the question was whether or not you could really adjust prices for the quality of the products. And he got into the whole question of productivity analysis and the hedonic framework. Now, hedonics was developed, as many people noted, I think he did, Manuel Lewis Court was a statistician at the, I think Ford Motor, General Motors, I think, yeah. But there was a very close relationship at that time between U.S. Industry and economics departments. There was another famous economist from Chicago who was working at Ford and working on similar questions. But hedonic framework was an outgrowth of this interest on adjusting prices for changes in the quality of products. And then he was deeply interested in what exactly the sources of productivity growth were. So I would argue that this is where he started. And so I will try to talk about this. But there are other themes that I'll talk about at the end that I think he played a major role. So in terms of his contributions, I think he laid the foundations for a very rigorous study of private and social returns. And I can see that in the conference today and in the papers we have in session, many people are still studying this very question about what is the rate of return to both private and social returns. And that was the social return was because partly the subsidy already from the state of Iowa through Iowa State, there was a question of how much the individual firms like Wallace's firms and the firms of intervention of Iowa State played itself. So it was a question of looking at what public and private roles were. And then the notion about comparing new to old goods was very deeply interesting to Svi and something he actively engaged in. And this enabled and still enables people to correct quantity and price changes. The fact is that now the price index embodies a lot of these ideas about quality change that they were eventually formalized in some ways in the Boskin Commission on which Svi served. I will point out that I was here in Paris when he got the word that he wasn't the chairman of the Boskin Commission. I can tell you, he wasn't enthusiastic about that either, but nonetheless he served, I'm sure, very, very faithfully and very well. And then he also did this notion of transforming the study of productivity and understanding the residual. So there was already, you know, this is in the 1950s, and the notion was, well, look, Solo had talked a lot about capital and people and true that Schultz and the people in agricultural economics in looking at agricultural productivity looked at capital too, or methods of capital. And they still found that they couldn't account for much of the growth. There was something out there called the great technical change, some unexplained productivity growth. And that was something that I think fascinated Svi his whole life. But these were issues that related together. Because in looking at inputs, of course, you wanted to make sure you adjusted properly for the quality. You wanted, and a lot of these inputs are very hard to measure except through value measures. And so you form indices, and if the indices are off, the inputs that you get are off. And so Svi was deeply concerned about that. So I would argue that each of these topics had major implication on research, and you know this. So I will talk about each one of these in turn and then talk about some historical narrative here, but also some current relevance. But also, I can't say that I speak for everything in this room. And a lot of people in this room I didn't mention in this because I wrote this 20 years ago. So you can use this as a benchmark for what I'm leaving out is what I should have had perfect foresight and decided what was to come. But let's see. So the fact is that the agricultural data, which is what motivated the original focus on returns to activity, was developed. And he held a huge influence on this. There were previous work. Schmuchler was somebody who had a huge role on him. Fabricant, Abramovitz. These were people who were growth accountants who were actually looking at how you would actually construct these aggregates of productivity. And as I was saying a minute ago, Schultz played a very major role. And Schultz himself was working on trying to explain productivity growth in agriculture. Schultz, however, because of his role maybe at Iowa State, I don't know, was attributing much of it to public investment, namely the extension stations, the stations supported by the, it's interesting that he overlooked Henry Schultz. Maybe he didn't like Schultz's politics, I don't know. But but there wasn't a lot of data to make any statement on in a precise way of what were the major sources of growth. But so already in this literature, there was a lot of discussion about technical change and whether or not it was influenced by economic incentives. But there was no quantitative measurement. These were all kind of discussed in a very loose way. The data just weren't there. And C played a major role over his life, with some of you in the room as well, in developing these major data sources. So his early work, his JPE paper in 58, was on the return, social rate of return to research activity. And he was primarily focusing on agriculture. Certainly the hybrid corn was explicitly agriculture and looking at exactly how the diffusion of ideas were. And this played this is huge in the sense that for many people, I remember hearing Dale Jorgensen going on about how much this one paper by C had influenced him as a graduate student at Harvard in thinking about what could be done with economics and what could be done with data and understanding economic problems. So, but C established a direct link between research and output. And that was something that was new. People talked about it, they knew about it. It was kind of like, you know, anecdotally you could tell these stories. But he developed data. So this is a genuine case where he was not just talking about taking an existing data set. And this is typical of much of his career, that he was gathering this data. I'm sure he had help from people like D. Gale Johnson and from T.W. Schultz and the connections in the agricultural community. But as I said before, agricultural economics was very much a thriving enterprise. A lot of modern econometrics that we think of came out of agricultural economics. If you look at the journals in the late 50s in agricultural economics, you'll actually see a very big contribution. So anyway, the point is that he was able to show that economics mattered and that there were developments that were basically stimulated. So this is like some evidence of directed technical change by profit motives. And basically the research activity was actually then stimulated by the economic benefits of doing it. And so he also was talking about something very fundamental, which we still are talking about today, with diffusion of ideas, imitation, and so forth. And it's still an open question about how these networks form, the diffusion forms. But he was able to put things together which had never been thought of before. He had some ideas of cost conditions, some idea of profitability, of what the hybridization techniques were, and he was able to build a data set and create a structure about disequilibrium that was it was much more quantitative than what had gone before it. And so I would argue, and I'm sure Svi would argue, I think many of you would argue, that this was a precedent to modern growth theory when he talked about things like transmission of knowledge and diffusion of knowledge playing a major role of structural change and enforcing structural change in the economy. And so his work basically was doing a lot of work on modern productivity analysis and looking at embodiment of productivity and looking at how productivity statistics were generated. And so by establishing these empirical frameworks, he was able to determine the impact of knowledge-producing activities. So the thing about Svi that was always the case, though, and maybe did him in a little bit, that he was not as much a self-promoter as you would. He really was somebody searching after the truth. I mean, it sounds very corny, but it wasn't. In the sense, he really qualified almost everything he did, almost to the extent of undercutting himself. I don't know, Adam, would you agree? Yes, I did. I mean, no, but but I think he really wanted to know what was going on. And so many people probably misunderstood it and said, oh, you know, this is not the modern style in economics. I could mention names, but I won't. But with it was a sense of an aura of integrity and of curiosity that I think he kept throughout his whole life, actually. So this is just part of his body of work. But I'll just list, I mean, I didn't list all the titles, and we know there's a huge amount. But I just want to note that a lot of his early work was in the Journal of Farm Economics, something we normally don't think about. We know econometrica, but it might be illuminating for some of you to look at the old issues of the Journal of Farm Economics.
Munlach, 1961. Yeah. First annihilator regression.
Munlach, yeah.
Munlach.
was in Journal of Farm Economics.
Also UC.
Yeah, Mundlach wasn't a Chicago boy, but he was a he was an ag resource, and Mundlach was part of the larger community of agricultural economics, exactly. And you know, and Nerloff too. A lot of the early Nerloff work on diffusion and so forth, ideas, distributed lags and so forth. So those are things that we're very, very much motivated by understanding this growth. So the question is quality measures, returns to schooling, and so forth. But then always throughout this theme was the notion of determining the biases of what different kinds of inputs were. And then if you remember the hybrid corn model, he was using logistic curves and how the logistics. And then out of that, and by the way, there's been a revival of that, you know, on spatial correlation models and so forth. But the fact is that if you looked at all the work on distributed lags, that was all motivated, again, initially by the diffusion and so forth. But he then took this whole question about correction of quality and understanding left out variables, the specification bias formula and the like, to looking at other questions and turns to education, errors in measurement, and distributed lags. Then the hedonic framework, I'll talk a little bit more about, and the formal activity about applied versus basic research. So we really wanted to separate out what the private return was. In that sense, he was taking on his former advisor, T.W. Schultz, by saying how much was the private return here? How much had been motivated by private incentives? But Schultz didn't. Schultz only had his own experience as chairman of the Iowa State Department. So, back in the early 60s or so, when Svi had already contributed enormously, and you realize the man is only 30 years old in 1960. He's been in a concentration camp for, 4 or 5 years, and basically not able to go to school, not even high school. So he starts his college education when he's, 18, 19 or something, but without any kind of
Yeah, he sat on Cyprus for 6 months.
Sat on Cyprus, yeah. So he was part of the Exodus story, you know. So anyway, so in terms of his work, he wanted them to build on this. So he'd started in agriculture, but he didn't stop there. And he started generalizing the body of work. And so he presented much more general analyses, but starting with these kinds of themes. They were all agriculturally rooted. And so he started presenting more general analyses of productivity growth and the puzzle of manufacturing and the economy at large. And he began to look for micro data. And this was something at the time that was pretty unusual. Surveys, micro data surveys were available. A lot of them from the Department of Agriculture, actually, looking at things like food and consumption and so forth. So that's why Margaret Reed and that group of people, all the work on the consumption function of Friedman was really generated from those, trying to understand those original agriculture department studies, why the time series and cross-section marginal propensity to consume were different and led to the permanent income theory. And Svi was there when all this work was being developed and was, I'm not sure his role in it, but he certainly was aspect. But Schultz helped partner this, helped father this in the sense of supporting the research on integrating this micro data. But he looked for micro data and he wanted to be able to go more deeply into the residual and to understand these different returns. And so the summation of his model, his thinking, was basically, I think, the R&D capital model. I think it was Bell Journal, was it still Bell Journal? What's that, Bell Journal? And it became a standard tool. He refined it and went back to it repeatedly. But he outlined the spillovers problem, this came from the whole body of work that he had worked up to in 79. So there were a lot of evidence of spillovers, not just in the diffusion, but in a sense you could see some applications that were developed in one technology spilling over to others and so forth. And so he was basically very, very influential in stimulating the profession. And then what he did was also have and Bronwyn, you can tell me if I properly attribute you here. Maybe I improperly attribute you.
Yeah. Well,
I understand. I put it in because you were here, so don't. That's a political move, don't. But no, it's factually correct, so don't get it wrong. But the point is that he was doing something which now people consider to be major achievement, mainly using these public data sets that were not available. Now there's a huge body of evidence, a lot of the work on the Scandinavian data sets, the registered data. These were all public data. that had not been used in this way. And he could then look at not only the firm level data on R&D and NSF, he put together a body of data which allowed people to do the kind of studies that are being reported on today and then being expanded on in this conference today in Paris. And so I think it really was one of the first attempts at integrating micro and macro databases and using US government surveys. So I think he pioneered the use of administrative database. I don't think there's any other way. And this, I think, created an infrastructure, which again, I don't think gets much credit for. People who build databases don't get much credit, right? Wouldn't you say, Bronwyn?
I'm happy now.
You're happy, okay, fine. No, but I think it's really the case. The profession is a little bit, in fact, you can't, I noticed that the Nobel Prize itself, if you nominate somebody like the Michigan Survey, if you nominate a group of people putting together a body of data, they will not accept it. They will not accept, the Red Cross qualifies, but for the Peace Prize. For economics, it's supposed to be an individual. So some large research agencies that build databases are just not considered. And so anyway, he did it, and he did it in a way that really, I think, deserves a tremendous amount of recognition, even today. He started something.
Well, also
go ahead, yes,
direct,
please.
It's not just that using the example, but it's also that he pushed very hard with the government to create things like the research data center.
Exactly, no.
Also a
but he had this public goods aspect. I mean, he believed in diffusion of ideas and diffusion, and he believed in really creating a public good. So he was always a scholar, I think, in that regard. I don't think he was trying to patent his own ideas and keep ideas secret. But he did also make some very powerful and statements that affect the development later on, and that is from the original database. I mean, I think in the 79 article, but then following afterwards, came up with estimates about elasticity of output with respect to R&D investments. And I think he made a distinction among industries. So this is just one example, but it had a lasting example about what rates of return were. And I don't want to get into details, and in fact, the details are old now. There are many more recent estimates we're hearing about today and tomorrow. So that was another whole line. But then the other notion that he wanted to explain this residual, and the fact of the matter is that if you just use direct physical measures of inputs, you weren't able to explain everything. Solow had, you know, found a version of that. So had Schultz, actually, in the agricultural community. So there was a very big structure. But you couldn't explain. There was just a huge residual missing. And so that was then the question of a spillover. How exactly these spillovers were there? And we're still in the business of quantifying those spillovers. We're still in the business of understanding networks of diffusion. And especially some of the models of endogeneity of diffusion are really somewhat still to be determined. There's a lot of work on spillover and networks and so forth. So this new data set allowed people to look at this distinction between public and private expenditure. And here are the main findings. And again, Bronwyn can correct me. That's why it's awkward here to be presenting this. What's that?
I have to go back to work.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. This is true 20 years ago. So we're frozen in time now. But no, but there's updating that's being done here in this conference. And that is that R&D contributed to productivity growth and had a high rate of return. And it wasn't uniform across different economic eras. And that basic research was more important as a productivity determinant than other types of R&D. I don't know whether Joel would agree with that based on his talk yesterday, but tell me what you mean by basic research, but you were talking a lot about applied research as well. And I think that that's something we've come to learn, which is there's a tremendous amount of knowledge that's acquired by trying to solve a problem. And you solve a problem and you fail, and then you immediately understand that as the source of knowledge. And I think that is that's very important. In fact, that was one of the reasons why John Tukey at Princeton shut down the statistics department. I don't know if anybody from Princeton is here, but you notice you don't have a statistics department. And the reason is he felt that statisticians, if left alone, would not work on interesting questions. But if they actually were embedded in some substantive problem, they'd actually do something important. And I think that was very much in the spirit of Sui. Von Neumann, by the way, said something similar. But privately financed R&D were more effective. And so the idea was then the government financing. So he really changed. You know, I'm not saying he was a rebel to Schultz or anything, but and Schultz, you know, just took this as something amazingly important to understand. So I think he understood the role of private financing, the role of private R&D, diffusion, spillovers, and these are things that continue to this day, and research questions that continue to this day. So, but all this data that we've heard about, the Compustat Tates, and some we just heard in an earlier session, we know that there's a tremendous amount of information still to be gained there. And even more as we merge the administrative data sets together. Because as you get more and more census records put together, the kind of things you might do in a Scandinavian country with this kind of, it would be amazingly better if we could actually link together the personal characteristics, looking at things like education, experience, and so forth and so on. So anyway, the point is that he really pioneered this process. And he, out of it, more than just pioneered collection of data, came with substantive findings that influenced the shape of the future direction of economics. And so he surveyed this in a later 1992 paper. Many of you know this paper. And he looked at the role of science in productivity. And so he played a very major role in understanding this and trying to integrate the role of science. And that's something that's still being integrated. We still don't know exactly the role of science. Many of you may contradict that. And you probably are right to contradict that, but I haven't seen it. So I'd be curious to see exactly what forms of subsidy for science and so forth are really appropriate. So these kinds of questions then slowly began to congeal. He started putting together these themes in his life. Always these themes were held together about how science, how technology, how to explain this enormous change in productivity in the larger economy. So I think this contributed to the modern theories of growth. Whether or not you do or not is a different matter, but clearly provided background. Philippe, I think, would, you're a heavy user of Grillikus, or at least cite his work, right? So, and I think it really was this notion on disequilibrium. And this older notion about appropriability, and then we talked about, heard some discussion about that yesterday, and we'll hear some more discussion. He started talking about this with Jacques and some other work as well. And so the new growth theory, I think, really did build on this work and just talked about, well, so the creative destruction was the old technology, the old hybrid corns, the corns that were no longer used, but many other types of technology and how depreciation, which we talked about, depreciation of knowledge was really just a form of creative destruction. So I would argue that this work is still central to clarifying ideas. And this other approach, though, I wish were more pervasive. And that is and I heard a lot of good papers in the last day and a half, and I really appreciated learning from them because it's not an area I work in. But certainly honest analysis of people saying what they did know and what they didn't know, and then taking theory and looking at data and trying to seriously take it. Let me talk very briefly about hedonics too, because even though it looks peripheral, as I say, if you're worried about quality inputs and you only value measures, you need to be able to come up with price functions that are empirical. And this, he started his role by building on this notion about quality adjustment. As I say, the theory was there, and Svi played several roles here. One, he did direct empirical work himself. He stimulated a body of work. He did some work I'll talk about in a second that had a huge influence on thinking about the pricing of automobiles and so forth. But he also stimulated others, people like Sherwin Rosen and others. And that was one feature of Svi that frequently doesn't get mentioned, is that he was actually somebody who stimulated others. He was very much giving of ideas and also stimulating of work. And I think that was really a really important feature. But anyway, we think of a price of a good or a bundle, some bundle, and we have a set of characteristics. And it's an area still being developed. I've certainly worked on this myself. But, you know, but Grillikus really revived the matter. There's some earlier work by Tenbergen, again, that had a way of looking at pricing, of certain ways of pricing bundles of attributes in the market. But he was very useful. not only in the sense of saying, look, this is useful for agricultural productivity, but then looking at CPI and looking at what is the true price of living, what is the true quality difference, and recognizing that with attributes of quality, and this showed up in his discussions of medical care in the United States and in many other notions, that quality was something that had lived a shadow life. And he was able to actually discuss quality and how you price quality and how you might measure quality change. And you can see that through the hedonic equations. And so what he did was basically then pioneer and basically start this quality adjustment literature, or at least get it going. He and Pollock, and then there are many others that worked on this question. But nonetheless, I think it was extremely important contribution. So he was, you know, using a like a CONUS index, but it was in characteristic space. And so he was, you know, big in pushing the Lancaster Gorman type of hedonic characteristics, and then trying to see how we could get pricing functions that would capture these kinds of bundles of characteristics. And then subsequent work about what happens when you omit characteristics. I mean, it's a huge issue in fitting hedonic functions. You have a residual, and it's totally unlikely the residual is uncorrelated with what's included. And so that started a whole literature by Svi's students more than by Svi himself, but nonetheless started a way of thinking about these things. And so the way this ended up, Boskin Commission had a bias estimate, I think, of about 0.7% per year. I don't know what the latest estimate is. Does anybody know? What, you guys are all supposed to know this. Wait, you don't know? It's still 7? What? 0.5. What? 0.5. Why did it go down? Or was 0.7 too high? Okay, anyway. Improve, yeah. So anyway, the point is that this got into the literature, and it gets into the price indices, and it gets into a lot of public policy discussions about what the true price is. And then, of course, there were the sources of productivity growth. And this is something that he got into. He was doing this partly with Jorgensen and by his own. And again, he was always very much attributing ideas to people and recognizing his forebears, if you will, the ones who had worked on these questions. And in this particular case, Tinbergen had written a very famous paper in 1942. You don't know the paper? You know it? No, you don't know it. You know, nobody knows it. But Svi cited the paper. And the amazing thing about the paper was published in German in 1942. So it didn't exactly get a huge readership in the West outside of Germany. But nonetheless, Svi built much on this. Tinbergen, by the way, is an amazing character himself, but that's another story. So the change in the productivity index is really understanding exactly. And then trying to put together these two different approaches. You come with indices of inputs and outputs, and then also just production function estimates, and linking the two together. And that was a major contribution, I think, to really start forming, thinking about it in those terms, and then establishing the nexus between those two approaches. So he analyzed again. I mentioned this. I don't want to keep boring you with this, but certainly talking about the rates of return and the role of the private sector and so forth. And then what he wanted to do is progressively move to aggregate level studies, but doing so in a way that was disciplined with micro data. And I know many of you here in the room worked on it and better qualified to talk about that than I am. But he started looking at these notions and then trying to look at these aggregate databases with much clearer inputs and outputs. And so given that the technical change was explaining everything, that naturally led to the question of science. What exactly was it that was leading to this expansion in the technical change? And I honestly believe that he, more than Solow and others, really emphasized this distinction, and certainly more than Schultz, who stimulated him before. So anyway, it was basically, he wasn't happy with that, and he was developing a research program that was designed to understand this residual. And but also recognizing the measurement problems associated with creating this residual. The fact that if you use these indices that were used, you had all kinds of misspecification problems. There were all kinds of omitted variable issues, and they needed to be accounted for. And so he was truly interested in these issues here, And so once back to the specification bias formula, which became kind of a way of life with him, at least in terms of some of his econometrics. But he was looking basically at things like how you would deflate outputs and so forth and so on. And so Grylicus basically started looking at the broader implications of these. So he kept, as he went through his life, getting broader and broader notions involving understanding the relationship of education, productivity, and different types of scientific activity. And this had a huge influence because he had a prominent role at Harvard and, you know, in the academic and public policy community, which is frequently not recognized, in bringing together. And because he was so honest and because he was so clear in stating exactly what the issues were, that he had a big following in government and people listened to him and acted on what his suggestions were. So let me, I should start concluding, right? But let me just talk a little bit about the Grylicus approach to applied econometrics. There are other areas where he was he had roles, but I will say less important than the three themes that I emphasize, but still important. But the thing about his style, though, is the part that's partly lost, I think, and I mentioned this earlier, but I'll repeat it again here, that when he was looking at agricultural economics and looking at this field, Schultz in particular was somebody who was very empirically oriented. You'd think of him almost as an ethnographer. I mean, Schultz went to a lot of these places, like he was living hybrid technical change and hybrid corn in Iowa when he was a young man. But also when he was studying things like agricultural transformation in Alabama, he went to Auburn for a year. He was studying the development of milk sheds and when cities were starting to form and agglomerations occurred, how agriculture changed. And so he inherited these traits. And I know for a fact. So when Schultz was talking about economic development and looking at the whole issue about the Lewis curve and economic development, he drew heavily on this book by anthropologist Saul Tax. And Grylicus himself drew very widely. Anybody who knew his work knew, right, that he was speaking very actively, reading the literature and reading whatever he could. And in that sense, he was viewing abduction in the sense of Peirce. The specification bias formula I mentioned already, but it was motivated specifically by an econometric problem, an accounting problem. But then, of course, he generalized it to a number of areas. He looked at this in terms of looking at returns to scale and simultaneity of bias in estimating production functions. This work by Grunfeld doesn't receive much attention these days, but they were talking about the case if you have a misspecified microdata, was it better to aggregate or not? Was it better to have the microdata or use the aggregated data? And they gave conditions under which it was better to use the aggregate data because of the misspecification. And they're counterparts to that, even with classical measurement error today. His work on distributed lags, you know, generalized the logistic curves. He considered a range of issues. This is one paper that he loved very much, and nobody else does anymore. But if you ever read it, there's work by Sargon and this whole group in England, and Svi was also a party to this, where he wanted to distinguish between a distributed lag model and a model with serial correlation, and then this what's called key term was the new addition to the term, the lagged exogenous variable, whether or not its coefficient was that particular configuration. So the point is then he also moved on later. And again, because one of the inputs was education, and one of the inputs also was in the quality of education. And so he got into this question of the returns to education. Now he got onto it late. You know, Becker and his crowd had actually been working a lot on estimating returns to education. But what Grylicus did is he started another line of work drawing on factor analysis and drawing a lot on the work by Lisserl and a lot of the work that was being done in Scandinavia with Gary Chamberlain. And they did this whole line of work about specification error with ability bias. Now, it's interesting, too, because he did sponsor, as I mentioned, Sherwin. Sherwin Rosen has this very nice paper with Bob Willis on really reinterpreting what the return to education is. And the addition there was using the theory of comparative advantage and really understanding that there are two sources of bias in an earnings function. One is the ability bias that everybody talked about and Zvi talked about. And then also the notion that there's heterogeneity in returns and there's selection on that heterogeneity in return. And Zvi didn't work on that question, but he fostered the work on that question through Rosen, sponsoring Rosen, who was his visitor at Harvard, I think, when that work started. So he did a lot of work on production functions, justifying, I think, largely, Pete would tell me if it's true, returns to scale, constant returns to scale in many contexts, although not universally. But looking at the at these questions, and then automobile, there's a famous paper that he did with Oda on writing a measurement of quality change and providing some important characteristics of how those prices, how automobile segments had changed and so forth. So let me just summarize, because I've run out of time, or running out of time, and running out of voice too. you know, there are a lot of other contributions that he made. When he looked, when he gave his presidential address to the Econometric Society, he was still focusing on this ability bias. That's kind of like saying the intercept is random, and therefore that could be correlated with schooling, and the coefficient on schooling could be upward biased. Instead, he found that it was downward biased in the, some of the work, and so that was interesting. But that was a predecessor then for later work, which then talked about a second source of bias, which is the heterogeneity in the return among agents, and how that would be correlated with schooling. And that could well explain the kind of phenomena that he was reporting, but he didn't get there. But he again, like his role, in a major role, he was a important figure in kind of facilitating this kind of transformation. And then use of sibling data, which is still used. John Bound, who's here and working on these questions, he worked on this very well. So let me just summarize. And again, I hope I haven't bored you too much with this, because it's, because Zvi, I think, was basically somebody who was somewhat unusual by modern standards, by current standards, I should say. And that is that he really had a deep desire to understand. I'm not saying that nobody has a deep desire to understand. Plenty of you do understand. But he went into the details in every possible way he needed to, you know. So he would read up on the literature. If you look at the studies that he did in hybrid corn, he did a lot of stuff on what was going on and how hybrid corn had been developed and what was the details and which counties had been most receptive and the level of education and so forth and so on. So he really wanted to understand. And I think that's the one thing that's really important. And so I will just summarize. When I visited Schultz near the end of his life, he mentioned Zvi. I mean, I didn't prompt him to mention Zvi, but he was bedridden already, Schultz, and he wasn't completely well. But somehow, spontaneously, he said he deeply admired Zvi because he stayed with a big problem until he solved it or illuminated it. And I think that was something that that's pretty rare. Our profession doesn't really recognize that as much as it should. And I hope this image, this tradition, this legacy is preserved and expanded on in work going forward from here. So thank you very much for your attention. And I think there should be corrections now from Manuel and Bronwyn and others, if I've done injustice here. Corrections, allow for corrections. Yes, Bronwyn. She has... But this is the best cuisine of all, right? These are ideas. If Zvi were here, he'd say, let her speak. No, speak.
I'm only going to say on hedonics. The work on hedonics is what inspired him to...
Okay, well, anyway, thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.